Plenty of news stories have said that Hurricane Irene is likely to cost billions of dollars. The storm certainly did damage, though less than some feared. At the same time, my local hardware store did just fine, selling out its stock of flashlights the day before the storm arrived. And no doubt some construction workers already have jobs they didn't before. A giant tree smashed a house near me, just destroyed it, and somebody's going to have to clean that up. We're going to try to sort out the economic effects of a disaster with Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money team. Adam, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, let's start by granting that destruction is awful and hurts a lot of people's lives. But some people do make money from this quite legitimately. So is there a case to be made that storms are not as bad economically as they seem?
I have to say that with all the destruction, one clear silver lining, one clear winner is us economics nerds, because we've been able to trot out the phrase broken window fallacy.
Okay.
That's an idea that comes from this awesome mid-19th century French writer, Frédéric Bastiat. And he pointed out that whenever a shopkeeper's window is broken, all the neighbors say, oh, this is actually good, because just think, you're going to send money to a glazier who's going to install a new window and the economic process will continue. But Bastiat pointed out that the person who had to replace the window probably would have spent the money on something else. And that's very much what we're thinking of today. If you have to repair your windows or your porch or a boat landing, but you would have done something else with it, bought an SUV, bought a TV, it doesn't really have a net benefit to the economy.
Okay, so granting that Hurricane Irene could not have been a net benefit probably to the economy, I wonder if there's a more subtle effect here. There are people who have insurance, presumably, and hopefully in at least some cases it covers the cost of the damage, and they'll take that insurance money and go out and hire construction workers, lots of whom need work right now. Is there a transfer of who wins and who loses here? A bunch of insurance company investors lose a little bit of money, but certain numbers of construction workers get jobs.
Yes, and that could have a stimulative effect, like the fiscal stimulus the government had. I mean, insurance companies, you know, they issue a lot of bonds, for example, just like the U.S. government does, and that money goes to investors. So when they spend money today based on money they borrowed from others, that is exactly what you said. That's transferring money from long-term investors and spending it today. The thing is, insurance companies are really good at estimating how much they're going to spend in a year. So I hate to say it this way, but you'd really need far more destruction than anyone was prepared for there to be truly that stimulative effect.
I want to ask about micro effects, not national effects, but effects on specific communities. I'm thinking of two examples. One is the Great Chicago Fire in the 19th century, which was a total disaster for that city, but seemed to clear the way for even more explosive growth. It certainly didn't hurt the city's growth. The other example, though, I'm thinking of is a small town that I have spent a lot of time in upstate New York that suffered a flood, like lots of New York and New England towns are suffering this week. It was a small town. The economy was weak, and the town is not even today seem to really recover from the devastation.
Right. I mean, what happened in Chicago is the Chicago Fire came when there was a very bad economic downturn. So what you had is all these smart, ambitious people from all over the country moving to Chicago and away from New York and Boston and Philadelphia and the other more established cities. And that effect was felt for decades as Chicago was just filled with this kind of ambitious entrepreneurial class. I don't know that that helped the nation overall. It might have just transferred all of that from the coast to Chicago. But yes, in many other cases, of course, especially places that are past their prime, you know, small New England towns would be a classic example. In those kinds of towns, it can be a disastrous event with absolutely no upside. The Chicago Fire could not have happened, I hate to say this, at a better time for Chicago. It was exactly when the United States needed a linchpin, a connecting point between the East and the new world of the prairies to the West, and Chicago was right there at the right time.
So Hurricane Irene is not likely to have much effect either way on the broad U.S. economy, although we may see some people who win as well as some people who lose.
Exactly. I think that's a way to really think about it. It reallocates the winners and losers, just like, you know, in New Orleans after Katrina, it was certainly a great place to be a glazier or to be a construction worker. It was not such a great place to be someone in a business that required, you know, lots of consumer spending. I don't know, an art gallery, a bookstore, that sort of thing. But there is a dead weight loss. That's not measured in GDP statistics, but there is just this loss of wealth. The country as a whole is poorer when things are destroyed. And just because the economic statistics might show a flurry of growth, that really doesn't mean we're better off.
NPR's Adam Davidson of our Planet Money team, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Plenty of news stories have said that Hurricane Irene is likely to cost billions of dollars. The storm certainly did damage, though less than some feared. At the same time, my local hardware store did just fine, selling out its stock of flashlights the day before the storm arrived. And no doubt some construction workers already have jobs they didn't before. A giant tree smashed a house near me, just destroyed it, and somebody's going to have to clean that up. We're going to try to sort out the economic effects of a disaster with Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money team. Adam, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, let's start by granting that destruction is awful and hurts a lot of people's lives. But some people do make money from this quite legitimately. So is there a case to be made that storms are not as bad economically as they seem?
I have to say that with all the destruction, one clear silver lining, one clear winner is us economics nerds, because we've been able to trot out the phrase broken window fallacy.
Okay.
That's an idea that comes from this awesome mid-19th century French writer, Frédéric Bastiat. And he pointed out that whenever a shopkeeper's window is broken, all the neighbors say, oh, this is actually good, because just think, you're going to send money to a glazier who's going to install a new window and the economic process will continue. But Bastiat pointed out that the person who had to replace the window probably would have spent the money on something else. And that's very much what we're thinking of today. If you have to repair your windows or your porch or a boat landing, but you would have done something else with it, bought an SUV, bought a TV, it doesn't really have a net benefit to the economy.
Okay, so granting that Hurricane Irene could not have been a net benefit probably to the economy, I wonder if there's a more subtle effect here. There are people who have insurance, presumably, and hopefully in at least some cases it covers the cost of the damage, and they'll take that insurance money and go out and hire construction workers, lots of whom need work right now. Is there a transfer of who wins and who loses here? A bunch of insurance company investors lose a little bit of money, but certain numbers of construction workers get jobs.
Yes, and that could have a stimulative effect, like the fiscal stimulus the government had. I mean, insurance companies, you know, they issue a lot of bonds, for example, just like the U.S. government does, and that money goes to investors. So when they spend money today based on money they borrowed from others, that is exactly what you said. That's transferring money from long-term investors and spending it today. The thing is, insurance companies are really good at estimating how much they're going to spend in a year. So I hate to say it this way, but you'd really need far more destruction than anyone was prepared for there to be truly that stimulative effect.
I want to ask about micro effects, not national effects, but effects on specific communities. I'm thinking of two examples. One is the Great Chicago Fire in the 19th century, which was a total disaster for that city, but seemed to clear the way for even more explosive growth. It certainly didn't hurt the city's growth. The other example, though, I'm thinking of is a small town that I have spent a lot of time in upstate New York that suffered a flood, like lots of New York and New England towns are suffering this week. It was a small town. The economy was weak, and the town is not even today seem to really recover from the devastation.
Right. I mean, what happened in Chicago is the Chicago Fire came when there was a very bad economic downturn. So what you had is all these smart, ambitious people from all over the country moving to Chicago and away from New York and Boston and Philadelphia and the other more established cities. And that effect was felt for decades as Chicago was just filled with this kind of ambitious entrepreneurial class. I don't know that that helped the nation overall. It might have just transferred all of that from the coast to Chicago. But yes, in many other cases, of course, especially places that are past their prime, you know, small New England towns would be a classic example. In those kinds of towns, it can be a disastrous event with absolutely no upside. The Chicago Fire could not have happened, I hate to say this, at a better time for Chicago. It was exactly when the United States needed a linchpin, a connecting point between the East and the new world of the prairies to the West, and Chicago was right there at the right time.
So Hurricane Irene is not likely to have much effect either way on the broad U.S. economy, although we may see some people who win as well as some people who lose.
Exactly. I think that's a way to really think about it. It reallocates the winners and losers, just like, you know, in New Orleans after Katrina. It was certainly a great place to be a glazier or to be a construction worker. It was not such a great place to be someone in a business that required, you know, lots of consumer spending. I don't know, an art gallery, a bookstore, that sort of thing. But there is a dead weight loss that's not measured in GDP statistics, but there is just this loss of wealth. The country as a whole is poorer when things are destroyed. And just because the economic statistics might show a flurry of growth, that really doesn't mean we're better off.
NPR's Adam Davidson of our Planet Money team. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. With the U.S. economy stuck in neutral, analysts are busy adjusting their forecasts to include the possibility of another recession. Most aren't predicting another downturn, just admitting the odds have increased. Meanwhile, policymakers at the Fed are divided about what to do next. The minutes from their last meeting, released yesterday, show some arguing for more aggressive action, while others think that would be a mistake. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports that policymakers at the Fed and in Congress are running out of ideas that haven't already been tried.
Sometimes it takes a while, but economies usually do snap back after recessions. But recessions brought by financial crises play by their own rules, and it's harder to bounce back. That's especially true of the last one, which ended 2 years ago. The housing sector is a mess, banks still have troubled mortgages on their books, the job market remains bleak, and Vincent Reinhardt thinks there's a 40% chance we'll be in another recession within a year.
And I think of that as we're flying the plane at a slower speed and closer to the ground. That is, we are less resilient to bad shocks.
Reinhardt is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's also former director of monetary affairs at the Federal Reserve. One of the things that troubles economists like Reinhardt is not just that the economy could be headed off course. It's also that there are few tools left to address that should things get worse.
The main problem we have, and that's about monetary and fiscal policy, if we were to slip into another recession, is that policymakers have already been there and done all that.
Basically, the government has two methods of dealing with a recession. One is fiscal. The government spends money or cuts taxes to try to boost spending. The other is monetary. The Federal Reserve lowers interest rates, which is also designed to get people spending. Here's where things stand now. On the fiscal front, with concerns about a huge budget deficit, there's little political will for a government spending spree. On the monetary side, the Fed has already pledged to keep short-term interest rates near zero until mid-2013. In recent years, the Fed has also tried an unconventional approach. It bought over $1 trillion in U.S. treasuries to push down long-term interest rates in the hope that might spur the economy. Mark Olson is a former member of the Fed's Board of Governors and now co-chair of a consultancy called Treliant. He says there's not much more the Fed can do.
It leaves us on the horns of a dilemma, I'm afraid.
Olson says the smartest move is also politically the hardest. Congress could pass a job stimulus program and, at the same time, reduce the long-term deficit through a host of painful cuts and tax increases. Doing that, he says, would assuage investors and get people spending again. But Olson says what's economically rational is politically unlikely. It's been 70 years since we've dealt with an economic hole this deep. And frankly, he says, as a country, we're pretty spoiled.
We're not accustomed to making the sort of sacrifices and adjustments that we had been willing to do in the past to move forward.
Without the ability to do that, and without access to the traditional monetary levers, what we're left with are a host of smaller ideas that try to tinker with the economy on the margins. Karen Dinan is co-chair of the Economic Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. She says targeted spending, like extended payroll taxes and unemployment insurance, helps. But the fundamental problem remains the same. There are still segments of the economy that aren't getting access to credit.
Big businesses that can go to the bond market, they're not having trouble borrowing at low rates. But there are a lot of small businesses out there that are finding it difficult or impossible to get credit.
She says until someone can figure out how to get money flowing to all the places it needs to go, it'll be hard for policymakers to fix the problem. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Apparently, we're not feeling so great about the economy right now. The latest consumer confidence report plunged to its lowest level in 2 years, and there's plenty to undermine confidence right now. Slowing growth, high unemployment, debt, political gridlock. That all leads to concern that pessimistic consumers will stop spending and undermine the economic recovery. But the way we feel does not always dictate how much we spend, NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
As the saying goes, when the going gets tough, the tough sometimes still go shopping. Tim Dolan is a freelance photographer whose business has grown in recent years. At a farmer's market in Los Angeles, Dolan says he still funnels money into anything having to do with his 1969 Buick Skylark, which he races every Thursday.
I wouldn't hold back on that. That's my sport, my hobby, my love, you know, my obsession. So whatever I want, I get.
Dolan budgets and tries not to waste money, but he also tries to avoid what he calls a poverty mentality.
I think, you know, you got to keep spending. You shouldn't, you know, tighten your purse strings because then you're going to choke the economy.
The Conference Board, a private research firm, said its consumer confidence index stands at less than half what it was before the recession. But consumer spending, it's actually higher than its highest levels 4 years ago.
There's traditionally been a big departure between what consumers say and what consumers do with regard to their spending.
Greg McBride is senior financial analyst for Bankrate.com, a personal finance website. Consumers often talk more about cutting back than they actually do. Then again, McBride says, the post-crisis recovery has left Americans still feeling financially insecure. Companies aren't hiring. People in companies are saving cash. Despite very low interest rates, there's no rush to buy homes. And McBride thinks all this suggests a possible break from the past, that people may actually clamp down on their wallets.
I think there's a risk that the spending is much more closely tied to those consumer confidence levels than what we've seen in the past, particularly given the tightness of credit and the penchant for consumers to pay down existing debt and work on boosting their anemic level of savings.
McBride says right now we're barely maintaining our spending levels, and a healthy economy requires new spending every month. 70% of the U.S. economy is driven by that spending.
Even a minor cutback in consumer spending ripples very quickly through the overall economy.
I'm not going to spend money just because I feel like the economy needs me to spend it.
Eric Green does public relations for the entertainment industry in L.A. He says he and his wife both maintain jobs through the crisis, but their house has lost value, they don't anticipate big raises, and they have two young children. So for the first time since college, Green says he's budgeting.
I had to buy a washer the other day, and it was like 3 months of research to find the best deal and wait for that sale to come, which I've never done before.
Green says if more money came in, he'd like to say he'd take the family on vacation, but more realistically, he'd save it for private school tuition. If people like Green increase their savings, it's hard to see how that turns into the kind of increased spending in coming months that economists say is so critical. Chris Christopher is an economist, one who is steadily employed by IHS Global Insight. He says the numbers he analyzes every day affect his confidence as a consumer.
Things do make me nervous.
Normally, Christopher says, he replaces his car every 4 years, which means he's due to swap out his 2007 Cadillac DeVille. Instead, he's waiting, and when he does get a new car, it'll be something modest.
I'm not going to a Rolls Royce anytime soon.
Christopher says he also opts for shorter vacations and hotels with fewer stars. But knowing what he knows about the U.S.'s dependence on consumer spending, he sometimes makes concerted efforts to spend. He might splurge on a haircut, for example, or he tries to shop at local stores and buy domestic products.
It's not for you, it's for the American economy.
Yes.
But until jobs, housing prices, and stock portfolios make a full comeback, he says, his wallet and his confidence will remain at odds. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.